Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. My microphone just went limp. It was like, no.
Not today. It's Monday. To do with you.
So we're back. We are back.
So sorry for the break.
Yeah.
Y'all.
So sorry about that.
I mean, I'm sorry for y'all, but I'm not sorry for me.
We were off in another galaxy.
Literally. No, did you really feel like, okay, when we got back home, it was like I had been on another planet?
Elena, there was no Chick-fil-A in sight.
None.
There wasn't a Chick-fil-A on the way there or on the way back. I mean, we stopped in Lubbock, so there was one there.
But yeah,
the way we came home, there was no Chick-fil-A. It was just roads.
Yeah.
Tumbleweeds.
Those things.
So they were blowing in the middle of the road, and I was like, ah, ah.
Yeah. It was very windy when we were driving to New Mexico.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was like six tumbleweeds flying across the road. It looked like they were all in a little band or something. Yeah. They're just like, hurry, go, go, go.
Oh, so funny. Yeah, so we went to New Mexico. Did you have a good time?
I had a really good time.
Good.
A very good time. Now, I did question why we all went to the same place, because I think we saw each other once when we were there, and that really bothered me.
Like Europe?
Yeah, like that. Why do we do that?
I don't know.
It's like, yeah, let's go on a trip together, and we see each other one time.
I know. Well, we each have our own families, and we each like to do different things.
There's a lot of chiefs in our family.
Yes.
Not always a bad thing, but sometimes it makes it difficult. That's why I try to be
Switzerland.
Yeah.
Just like, that's exactly what I did. I was like, they were like, what do we do tomorrow? And I'm like, y'all tell me and I'll be ready to go.
That's the way to do it, really.
I just don't have an opinion. I just don't want to plan anything.
Yeah. Don't make me plan.
That's kind of the whole point.
Yeah. I mean, if there's something that I really want to do, I'll say, okay, I want to do this. I don't care what day, but just please let me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of, yeah, that happened. And I really loved hiking in the mountains. That was one of my favorite parts. And horseback riding, which you did not get to go on.
No, I didn't.
You wouldn't have enjoyed it.
I probably would have done it if it was just me, but I had the girls.
Of course.
The guys were golfing that day.
That makes it difficult.
It just was not, and it's not something that, like, my anxiety would have just imploded me.
Let me go ride a horse.
No. And I mean, I can't have them all on my horse, so
no.
They would have had to be on other people's horses, and I would have been a nervous wreck. So,
yeah.
Anyway, my nervous system can't take that. so we just hung out at the house, and
well, I mean,
it was fine.
Yeah, you pay for a rental house, and so you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was nice. But we went to Roswell.
We did.
We did get to do that together.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that that's another activity where I had the girls. And so I wasn't able to like read everything, but
a lot of reading material.
So much reading material.
Yeah.
And I didn't see a book. Like I looked in the gift shop for like a book that was like a museum book, you know, that had everything in it.
Like a magazine kind of
thing. Yeah, like from the museum. But I didn't see anything of the sort. So I'm going to do some independent research. I mean, okay. I know pretty much
Right.
About Roswell, but it was cool being there. The whole town. the town is like a stoplight, by the way.
Yes. Yeah.
But the whole town, like, everything's alien themed.
Everything. Like, I mean, as soon as you get in, you see alien statues.
Yes.
And
I was like, yes, I'm home. No, that was really cool. I liked that a lot.
So the very when you first arrive into Roswell, there's a souvenir shop. I forget what it's called, with two alien statues outside. And we stopped there and we walk in and the cashier lady that's working there, she's sitting there talking to two customers about all these conspiracy theories. And I'm like, oh, this is it.
We are in it.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, she loves it.
Absolutely.
Oh, man. That's funny. I just, yeah, I was really shocked at how, I don't know. It just, you're right. It did kind of feel like we were somewhere else.
Yeah.
I mean, we were somewhere else. But,
but not on Earth.
The wild horses. I've never seen horses by the street like that. Like, yeah, you were just driving down the street.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, like you're going to a restaurant. And they're just standing there at the intersection.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, hi.
Stopping for a bite to eat right on the side of the road. And yeah, there's elk everywhere.
Elk. We had an elk in our yard one day.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of caterpillars.
Oh, I didn't see any of those.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chris and I on our first hike on one of the mountains, there were elk everywhere. And I thought they were right on the path that we were on. And yeah, I was like, how are we going to get by? Like, do we go? Do we turn around
past them?
They were not bothered. I mean, one did start walking towards us and I was like,
oh no.
But yeah.
Did you have your elk spray? I don't know. Is that a thing? I know of bear spray, but I, you know.
Yeah, I did pick up a stick, but I don't know what that would have done. I don't know.
It would have snapped. That's funny.
But no, they were unbothered, really.
Yeah, it was cool. I liked it. I loved White Sands. Did y'all go to White Sands?
No, we did not.
Oh, my. That was insane.
Did you have a lot of sand in your pants?
I still have sand in my pants.
That is why I did not want to go.
Yeah, actually, there's a bag of clothes out there that I need to, like, for some reason, I have two bags of sandy clothes, and I thought I washed them all, but there's another bag.
Oh, no.
That's got all the shoes in it. So I need to take that outside and deal with it. But
see, that's why I knew that was going to happen, mm-hmm, and I was like, I'm not interested.
That is wild because it's, you feel like you're somewhere else.
See?
It's weird because you're driving through the desert. We stopped at Pistachio Land.
Oh yeah.
I'm sorry if you can just fast forward through all this if you're not interested, but my brother really wanted to go to the world's largest pistachio.
And now that I would have loved to have gone to.
Whatever. It was funny. So yeah, we stopped there and everything was pistachio themed. There was like pants that had pistachios all over them. Like not the nut, but just like a picture of pistachios. Yeah. But anyways, that was on the way to White Sands. And so when you're driving through the desert and suddenly you see mounds of white sand in the distance.
And how did it get there?
That's just crazy.
The nature's so weird.
It's wild. And it's weird.
Yeah.
But I was just like, it's the softest sand I've ever felt. Mm. And I've been to many beaches.
Yeah.
It's just, you can sit in it and it just conforms to your body. It's not like, it's not like sitting on the beach where it's kind of hard.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just pillowy sand. It's really crazy.
That's weird.
Yes. Anyway, I thought that was really cool. The girls loved it. We had sleds and...
Oh, I'm glad they got to experience that.
The twins just were, that was their...
They were in their element.
Oh my gosh. They were throwing their bodies down the hill, rolling.
And you're like, have at it. Just
the
go.
The minute Daisy would come off her sled, she would just roll like dramatically, like, whoa. It was funny, but yeah, we had a good time. So thank you guys for understanding.
Yes.
We will have extra content coming your way. And can we talk about Nancy Guthrie?
Please, let's do it.
What the crap? What the crap? I'm serious.
I know. I stopped listening to all of the updates because there's
no updates.
Nothing. they just keep on.
The updates are she's been missing for how many ever days. We still don't have any information.
That's it. Like, they post these updates and I'm like, you're going to tell me the same thing, that she's still missing and there's nothing. So I'm not going to listen.
I think we've said this before, but like, we're all for, you know, police having the privacy to conduct their investigation, right, and all of that. But it literally feels like they have nothing. That's what it feels like. And you remember, I think we talked about this on a Patreon episode. Was it last month or the month before, maybe, when she very first went missing?
Right.
And I said, you know, this couldn't be a kidnapping. Like, they're not out for ransom because they hadn't, at that point, they hadn't requested any money.
Right.
And it had been days.
Yeah.
And so that's the weirdest part to me, is that why wait all that time to request money? And then when money's offered, mm-hmm, there's no arrangement.
Well, I know one of the people that called in as a ransom was found to be
the Bitcoin thing.
I don't know if it's the same one, but he was arrested. They found a man that was fraudulently asking for ransom, and he had nothing to do with her missing. He just was, mm-hmm, acting like the person. What? Why do people do that?
I don't know.
Why would you put yourself in the middle of all of that?
I mean, I want to go help look for her. That's right, the extent of me wanting to put myself in the middle of it. But yeah, I mean, I can't see myself waving a red flag going, ooh, arrest me.
Oh, it's so strange.
What? This whole thing is insane to me.
There's a lot of weird things about it. Like, there's a huge group, I think, from Louisiana that's wanting to help search and like do their drone thing, and the law enforcement wouldn't let them help.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. I don't understand. I mean, I get it messes with the, you know, if getting,
but can they tell them not to fly a drone? I mean,
I believe you have to have clearance to fly a, like a,
well, we have a drone.
I don't
like
know.
Daniel has a drone.
I don't know how that works, but some places you have to have clearance. You can't
fly at a certain height.
Yeah, exactly.
Or like, you can't fly it around Disney.
See, okay.
So there are like no fly zones.
Okay.
So maybe they're taking,
knowing that it's a crime investigation area.
Crime scene.
They wanted to get clearance and they did not get clearance.
I say take the help that you can get. Because you clearly...
That's what a lot of people were mad about.
I'm just feeling like they've... I just don't know. I mean, and I sympathize. I have no ideas. Like, I'm more confused now than I ever was.
Yeah. I mean, such a big desert area. And...
But for what?
Yeah.
This is strange. It's... The strange part about it is that... I mean... The Lindbergh baby, is that the last celebrity, you know, high profile? I mean, I can't, it escapes me thinking of the last high profile kidnapping we had.
Mm-hmm.
What was that girl's name? It was in the 70s. Oh, man. She was kidnapped and then she got Stockholm syndrome and she stayed. I can't remember. Someone's screaming at us right now with the name. But I just cannot think of another high profile. And why her mom? Why not Savannah Guthrie herself?
Well,
or one of her children?
Just recently, before the kidnapping or abduction or whatever happened to her, Savannah had gone into her hometown and did a whole production, a TV show about where she lived and where she grew up. And her mom went on and they went and ate at a restaurant together. And so,
maybe someone got fixated.
I don't know. They were saying maybe someone was jealous of Savannah. There's so many different things that have been said.
Yeah, it's just.
But she's back. She's back on the Today Show, listen, Savannah.
And we talk about that all the time, don't we? Yeah. Life goes on.
Yeah.
And what are you? What is she gonna do? What is she meant to do?
I haven't watched it since she's been back, so I don't know. When did she come back?
I saw when she came back, like when Craig Melville who got the promotion to anchor, and she came and congratulated him on that.
Oh,
and seemed to be in good spirits.
Okay,
but I just, oh my Lord,
yeah. I don't know.
Anyway,
I have hope and faith that Nancy will show back up, whether she's here with us on Earth still or not. She'll be found somehow, but I don't know. It's such a mystery still.
The more time goes by, the more I think time will go by before we know something.
Like, yeah.
Anyway, it's just wild, and this is honestly weirder than any case I've ever seen of a missing child, or, you know, because it's usually children.
Well, JonBenet Ramsey, that was that still baffles
Elizabeth
us.
Smart.
Yeah.
And there's like a motivation there, you know, someone easily subdued.
Right.
Anyway, I hope that they get answers for the family. I don't know. It's insane.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're 15 minutes in here.
Should we just make this an episode?
Past 15 minutes. And we haven't even discussed. Okay. So let's get in. And I'm sorry if you had to fast forward through all that. But we'll just jump right in. December 21st, 2012. Josephine Bullaroo, I think, said goodbye to her 24-year-old son, Alvin Bullaroo, as he headed out the door of their family home. It was around 6 p.m., and Alvin had just showered and gotten himself all cleaned up to go out with a friend downtown San Diego to hit up some nightclubs. Now, San Diego was about an hour away from where Alvin lived in Fallbrook. But according to his mom, going out on a Friday night was his routine. Alvin was very hardworking. He was in the military and he managed a care home for the elderly.
Oh, wow.
So a night out with friends was his little reprieve from a busy life. And he deserved it, which is why Josephine wasn't too alarmed when Alvin wasn't home the following morning. It really wasn't until multiple calls to her son the entire day after she last saw Alvin went straight to voicemail that she started feeling nervous and she wanted to involve the police in the situation.
Oh, no.
So Josephine called to report her son missing on December 23rd. You know, we're approaching Christmas and this just isn't right. Something's not right here.
Oh, no.
And she let them know, I haven't heard from my son. I haven't seen him since the 21st. And this is not like him. He's not the type to turn his phone off at all or be out of touch. He was extremely close to his family. But the police told the family, what do you think? What do you think the police told the family?
Wait 24 hours or he's an adult?
He's an adult. Yeah. He doesn't have to come home if he doesn't want to. He went out clubbing. Maybe he's drunk. Maybe he's hungover. Maybe he's sleeping it off
and he'll be back tomorrow.
Exactly. So the family hired a private investigator.
Okay. Don't waste any time.
I love them. I mean, they're just like, okay, we're not going to mess around. We're not waiting the 24, 48 hours, 72 hours, whatever it was that they were told. So the PI got straight to work combing the San Diego nightclub scene. He checked with bars, patrons who had been out the night of the 21st, even pulled CCTV from the area, but nothing put Alvin in the vicinity at all.
Oh.
It's really strange.
Huh.
His car wasn't picked up on any traffic cameras, and that friend that Alvin was going out with that night never saw Alvin that night.
Okay.
Yeah. So Alvin's brother John felt like something bad must have happened to Alvin on the way to San Diego because it appeared that he never made it there.
Gotcha.
After nearly 2 weeks of investigation, the PI was no closer to finding Alvin.
Two weeks.
Ugh. Alvin's brother John was like, well, what are the police doing at this point? Are they doing anything at this point? And so he called them to see if they were making progress. Well, this time, they did have some information.
Oh, really?
For Alvin's family. Yeah. They had found his car.
And you weren't going to tell anybody?
Right.
Hello?
Right. So they had been running Alvin's plates and found that Alvin's car had been in the Albertsons parking lot in Fallbrook. As you can probably imagine, Alvin's brother's like, I'm sorry, what? You found his car? Like, why didn't you call us?
Right.
And it could have been something like they just found his car and it just happened that they just got the information or whatever it was. Okay. But it felt like to the family that they just weren't being informed.
Right.
So police were like, yeah, why don't you go over to the Albertsons parking lot and see if it's his car? Like, just go see if it.
Okay, so you know it's there, but they didn't like.
I don't know if the police went and looked, but it was run. Like the plate was, someone reported that the car was in the Albertsons parking lot. I don't know if the police went to see, but they told Alvin's family to go look.
You go do the work. We're just going to sit right here.
I'm sorry? What? So anyway, they went and it was Alvin's Toyota 4Runner. So they called the police back and they were like, hey, the car's locked. So can y'all come open the car?
Right.
Like, this is his car. Police came and, you know, usually in these type of situations, I hear that they won't open the car.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we don't have the right to. We don't want to be sued.
Right.
But for whatever reason, they did make entry into the car. The driver's seat and passenger seat were pretty unremarkable. But when police opened the back door, they found a sleeping bag shoved down into the footwell.
No.
And inside was Alvin's body.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. No one could understand how this type of thing could have happened to Alvin, of all people, especially when I tell you what was done to him. Alvin was born April 13th, 1988 in the Philippines. His mom said, as a baby, he looked like a little cookie. And so that just was his nickname, Cookie.
So
cookie.
Sweet.
Even into like adolescence and adulthood. Now, growing up in the Philippines, he was the oldest of five children. And I mentioned earlier how close he was with his family, mm-hmm. his parents, his siblings, especially his mom. He lived near his cousins and just down the road from the ocean. Alvin used to carry his little sister on his shoulders to their grandma's house because she didn't want to walk all the way there.
So
which
sweet.
Probably wasn't far, but
yeah.
He was just the best big brother. He loved watching anime with his brothers. And even though it was all boys, he always made his little sister feel included.
Aww.
He loved to sing karaoke with his dad. He loved to dance. I wasn't able to find out when exactly he moved to America, but he earned his bachelor's degree from Kaplan University and went on to get his master's from Phoenix University.
Wow, you go.
Yeah. He and his brother, John, who were close in age and had practically kind of grown up like twins, done everything together, gone to every school together. They both joined the military. And Alvin was really proud to serve his country of the United States.
Love it.
Alvin first served in the Navy for 4 years before joining the Army Reserves in November of 2011.
I love that he's just trying new things.
I know. At the time of his death, he was serving as second lieutenant assigned to the Medical Service Corps. He was a standout among his peers, and he was about to accept a promotion to commanding officer of the medical unit.
So impressive.
So, and he was 24. I mean, he was so young and just working his way up. Finally, he was managing and doing the administrative work for his family's healthcare business. I mentioned earlier, it was this elder care facility. His brother John said that Alvin never had any enemies and was just a genuinely good person. So they had nothing when it came to providing police with names of people that might have wanted to harm Alvin.
Yeah, this made no sense at all.
Yeah, made no sense. The night he was found, the medical examiner came to the scene and loaded Alvin's body from the car onto the gurney to transport him to the morgue. If it were me, if I may, I'd have transported the body in the car because...
You lose valuable.
Right. I go to the school of Joseph Scott Morgan, and he says that it's imperative to preserve evidence. You don't open the bag. You don't move the body. I mean, you've got to identify and do your due diligence. Make sure the person's not alive, of course. But preservation of evidence. I mean, Cousins on Crime, episode one.
Mm-hmm.
Blue Mound Massacre.
Right.
Destroyed the crime scene.
We can learn a lot.
I mean, just right out of the gate. Mm-hmm. Remember the Karen Reed trial when we learned along with the jury that investigators were collecting blood in red Solo cups that they got from Joe Schmo down the street that they didn't even know?
Yeah.
What?
Who? Why? When and where? That's so unacceptable.
It's just like, I don't have any words for that. I just don't even know what to say about that.
I know.
You call into question everything, essentially, about an investigation when you do something stupid like that. I won't even go into the fact that transporting a deceased individual from a car to a stretcher in a grocery store parking lot probably wasn't the best course of action, you know, for the public or his family.
Yeah.
So after loading up Alvin's body, they did tow his car to the crime lab. See, they were taking his car anyway. So why not just leave him in there? I was surprised to learn that they didn't find much of anything in or on the car that had any evidentiary value. But Alvin's body told a graphic and violent story.
Okay.
Alvin had been shot twice.
Oh.
And he had sustained over 44 stab wounds.
What?
And his throat was slashed.
Okay, that really sounds personal.
Yes. His death was brutal. It was drawn out. It was overkill.
Why? What happened?
You know, and this gives investigators a little bit of insight right away. Like you said, feels personal, and it kind of gives them an idea of who they're looking for. Alvin's car, though, was a secondary crime scene. It wasn't the place where he was attacked and killed because there would have been blood everywhere.
Yeah,
there would have been blood spilling out onto the pavement in that parking lot.
Oh, my Lord.
It was just like the blood evidence was confined to that sleeping bag. So they found themselves asking the same questions that they did in day one. Where was Alvin going that night? Where did he go when he walked out of his house? Because he never planned to go to San Diego. It seems like he had other plans.
Okay.
If his car ended up in this grocery store parking lot.
Okay.
You know? Alvin's family was able to produce his cell phone records to detectives, which showed that he was in contact with one number leading up to the day he disappeared, you know, in the several days before. And that number kept pinging off a tower at Camp Pendleton base. So they assumed that the person Alvin was speaking with was also in the military, stationed at Camp Pendleton as well. this is good. We're making progress here, you know, and I bet they were hopeful that this phone number was the key to solving this entire mystery, but it wasn't going to be that easy. That phone number had been purchased under the name Michael Walsh. Who?
Yeah.
Alvin's family didn't know anyone named that. This person was not known to law enforcement. And it hadn't come up in the investigation so far. So they were just like, who? Well, what about CCTV?
Yeah.
Right? Surely the fact that Alvin was found in his car in this grocery store parking lot would yield some footage.
Especially in 2012.
Right. And it wasn't just an Albertsons. It was like a shopping center.
Okay.
So there were other stores that might have also had cameras.
Okay. So by all means, yes. Let's go look.
So cameras from Albertsons showed Alvin meeting up with someone on December 21st. He drives into the parking lot and parks. This other person pulls up next to him. And this person gets out, gets in Alvin's car, and they leave about 8:40 that night.
Oh.
Leave the parking lot.
Okay.
A few hours later, around 11:30, Alvin's car is seen returning to the parking lot where someone, not Alvin, they don't think it's Alvin, getting out of the driver's seat. And it looks like they're looking around the vehicle. They look in the trunk. They're looking in the side, you know, through the side window. They get back in their car that they came in.
Okay.
And they left.
At what time did you say? 11?
About 11:30.
Okay.
So the video was really grainy and it was nighttime. So it wasn't super helpful. And they couldn't work out the make and model of the second car.
Oh.
Let alone who the other individual was.
Gotcha.
And they believed that person obviously to be their suspect because Alvin's car never moved after that. So they believe that Alvin was killed that night, taken there, dropped off, and he had been there the whole time.
Yeah. Ugh.
But they had those phone pings originating from Camp Pendleton. So they began driving around the base looking for a similar car. You know, they, like I said, they couldn't really even tell the color of the car. They couldn't tell. It just looked like a car, you know, like any other car. So they're looking around. But another vital piece of evidence was that sleeping bag that Alvin was found in.
Okay.
It had a weird name on it. And after speaking with Alvin's family, police learned that he didn't own a sleeping bag. Like,
that he wasn't, knew of.
Yeah, that they knew of. And he wasn't known to, like, go camping or anything. So they believed that this sleeping bag belonged to his killer. But who? Michael Walsh? Well, in an effort to find out, they began searching stores in the local areas. You know, we see this a lot in investigations. They're trying to track down a certain type of rope, or they're trying to track down a certain type of shoe. And they'll go to all these links to find the model number and how many were sold. And it's really amazing when they do these things. They didn't have to look very hard to find the sleeping bag, though.
Okay.
Considering, because it was a small town.
Okay.
And so they went to Walmart and other stores, and none of them sold the Algony brand sleeping bag. It only left one more place to check, which was the commissary at Camp Pendleton.
Okay.
They went to the exchange, and if you're not familiar with the exchange, it's like a Walmart or a Target, smaller, but it's got everything from electronics to shoes to perfume to camping gear. That's right.
Specifically Algony
brand.
That's
right. So they had the exact brand of sleeping bag that was found concealing Alvin's body. It came from the commissary.
Oh my gosh.
Now, this is what I mean by they didn't have to really look too hard, because there were only 3 sleeping bags sold in the month of December.
Well.
Yeah. The first transaction was from a man who bought 2 sleeping bags, and he was going camping with his grandkids. They checked him out. he literally went camping. He had the sleeping bags and they ruled him out. The other transaction was from December 21st.
Oh.
The day that Alvin went missing.
So earlier in the day. It was purchased.
Yes, earlier in the day. So police believe he was murdered that day.
Yeah.
So now they're thinking this was planned.
Planned. Yeah. Exactly.
So the store had loads of cameras, and unlike Albertson's parking lot, these were really clear.
Okay, thank you.
Clear footage.
I would hope so, being on the base.
Right. So the surveillance video showed a white male in a black t-shirt, short military haircut. They watched this man purchase the sleeping bag with a credit card. The lead investigator describes this next part to A&E's murder at the motel, which was a show that I watched that featured this case. They have this transaction, and that's great. But the record from the base only showed a portion of the credit card number, not the name of the credit card holder.
What?
So in order to access the name associated with this credit card number, they would, you know, they had to get a warrant, you know, and that takes time.
Right.
And they went through the steps, but they didn't want to just wait around for that. They're like, there's got to be another way we can figure it out. So they asked the exchange to pull all the transactions matching that credit card number.
Okay.
They married it up with the CCTV footage to verify that it was the same person. And so they just start going through all the transactions from that date.
Love it.
Like before. They're trying to figure out if any of these transactions, if they can see a name, he was required to give a name or something like that. And most of these transactions, pretty much all of them, was just the information, the credit card, the date, you know, the sale number, probably the cashier number.
Yeah.
Except for one.
Okay.
Something happened with the sale, and I don't know what happened. By the grace of God, though, he had to sign for it.
What?
For some reason.
Okay.
Yeah. So he had to sign for it. It had his name on there.
That's incredible.
Kevin Kosay.
And who is that?
Yeah. Well, Kevin Kosay was 23 years old. He was in the Marines and he lived on base at Camp Pendleton. His relationship to Alvin was immediately unknown because they didn't come across this name. Alvin's family didn't know him. By now, they had Kevin's credit card records.
Right.
So they are looking through his transactions.
What did he buy?
Right. Well, detectives learned that Kevin had rented a room at the Fallbrook Inn.
Oh.
Which was a motel in Fallbrook the night Alvin supposedly went out clubbing. Upon further review of Alvin's cell phone records and his social media accounts, authorities learned that Kevin and Alvin's relationship was dating, hooking up, but it was very new. Very new. They had only exchanged like a handful of messages back and forth on Facebook, which is how they met shortly before the murder. It's unclear if all of Alvin's family knew that he was gay. I did read one report that said his brother knew he was gay and did share that information with police because he felt it could be relevant.
Sure.
They thought he was going, like his brother thought he was going out to a gay club. So that's, he was like, check there first.
Right.
But it does appear that Kevin and Alvin's interactions were clandestine.
Gotcha.
Especially on Kevin's end, because he had this burner phone registered to a Mike Walsh.
Yeah. He's,
which does not exist.
Obviously up to some shady stuff.
That's right. That's right. Well, police went to this motel, as you do.
Yes, please.
And they approached motel staff with a photo lineup, which included a picture of Kevin Kosay. And they said, you know, do you recognize anybody in the photos? And the look on the receptionist's face must have been something to behold, because she pointed to Kevin and kind of held her breath a little bit. They all remembered that guy.
Okay.
Because he left the room in a bad way, starting with the big red stain on the carpet in the middle of the room.
Well, why have they not called police?
There you go. There you go, Lena. The bedding was missing.
What?
There was a hole in the door.
Dude.
It was just shocking state of affairs. And
what? I'm so confused.
I know, right? Well, they let the police look in this room that Kevin had rented weeks before, but now
my Lord.
Had been thoroughly cleaned and repaired, I guess. But you never know. It is a motel after all.
Oh, they need to make their money.
Right. So oh my gosh. There's nothing obviously out of place when they go in. There's nothing left behind that doesn't look like it belongs there. But when crime scene personnel arrived, nothing was getting past them. Can you imagine being a crime scene like investigator and just staying in hotel for,
oh yeah,
you know, pleasure? And then you're like,
what happened here?
Scanning the whole room. They probably only stay at certain places.
Oh, I'm sure.
Or they probably don't stay at any of those places. Anyway, the CSI found specks of blood everywhere. On the baseboards, the walls, even the furniture. I don't know why.
I have so many questions.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't call the police when they first saw the state of the room, especially that big red stain on the floor. But they did tell police that they thought it was spaghetti sauce.
Shut up. No, it's never spaghetti sauce.
It's never spaghetti sauce.
And so they cleaned it.
They had it cleaned. Yeah.
I can't speak for the rest of the episode.
I don't know what it, like, I didn't see any pictures of the carpet, but it had been cleaned. Whatever they thought it was, they cleaned it. But when crime scene techs pulled back the carpet pad was saturated.
Well, yeah.
With a reddish brown substance that the CSI knew wasn't spaghetti sauce.
Holy moly.
Yeah. A presumptive test was positive for human blood. And when compared to Alvin's blood, it was a match.
Can I see the person that cleaned this? Like, could you imagine what was going through their head when they realized it's not spaghetti sauce?
I mean,
what?
Yeah, I don't know. I imagine that people see some. Listen, when I was in college, I cleaned houses to make money. And, I had some really weird things left behind for me to clean. Okay. So things that you would never think someone would leave for someone to clean.
Oh, gosh.
But I imagine that in a motel, you probably see a lot of weird things. And this,
like a bowl of spaghetti dropped on the floor.
Right. And like what appears to be blood spatter on the walls and baseboards.
Oh, my gosh. No.
Yeah, it seems like someone should have called somebody, but authorities were pretty confident that they had found the primary crime scene because of the volume of blood under the carpet was just indescribable. I mean, indicative of someone who had been stabbed repeatedly with their throat slashed. Now, the detective said they'd never seen anything like it in their career before. And it really renewed their perspective as to the brutality of the crime. And the more they dug, police started to believe the motivation for Kevin establishing this friendship with Alvin was to murder him all along.
Oh, he had this planned.
Yeah.
It wasn't like rejected.
So you know what? As I was researching this case, I'm thinking this is a military closet gay guy who's ashamed of who he is and he just has to take it out on somebody. But that didn't seem to be the case at the end of the day. So lead investigator Dave Hillen told A&E's Murder at the Motel that Kevin's cell phone records showed his burner phone pinged off the cell phone tower right next to Albertson's the night Alvin's body was found, meaning he came back to the crime scene.
What? To check to see if the car was still there.
So they had him on CCTV too, pulling into the parking lot, seeing police.
This guy.
And he hightails it out there. Oh. Like, just, can you imagine?
The audacity.
So Kevin had returned back to base. Remember, this was Christmas time. So they were on holiday break. He returned back to base 2 days early, which the detectives say nobody in the military returns early.
No.
They take every second they can with their family. And then they'll come back. Yeah. So they believe that he came back early to get rid of Alvin's car.
Oh.
Yeah.
And by the time he got back, it was found.
And Jimmy Crackcorn, if he didn't pull in there when police were surrounded the car.
Oh, gosh.
But they had him. This was enough. This was enough for an arrest warrant. And they did just that in February of 2013. They arrested Kevin outside his barracks. At his arraignment, his bail was set at $5 million, which was higher than what the state recommended.
Okay.
Just goes to show you that the court, they just felt he was so dangerous. He could not be let out in the general population. And they believed he would flee, too.
Oh, I'm sure.
So now, in preparation for Kevin's murder trial, I don't know what investigators expected to find. I figure they were like, okay, let's try and find the murder weapon. You know, an investigation doesn't just stop because you've arrested someone. You're now in trial mode.
Oh, yeah.
You got to
get all the evidence we can.
Everything you can. And they found the gun that was used to shoot Alvin. It was in Kevin's car.
This guy.
Right. I don't think they anticipated learning who Kevin really was, though. Upon searching Kevin's barracks, they discovered a journal with what appeared to be a confession written in it. Let me read you an excerpt.
Okay, please.
Excerpt. My name is Kevin Kosei. I'm 23 years old and currently serving in the military corps. Over the past few years, my life has been heading in a strange direction. Tonight, I had to kill for the third time.
I knew it.
It was a guy named Alvin Bellaru out of Fallbrook. He went on to say that he had to survive in my fight. It was this guy or me.
Okay.
And he said that he was fighting against an organization called the Musgrove Organization, which he felt had it out for him for years.
Oh.
Kevin claimed that this organization was taking control of him. Who this organization was, like their relevance to Kevin or even their validity, was not clear, but it sounded a bit like an unraveling mind.
Right. Like a mental problem.
Yes. I actually found a Reddit thread where this person said that they served with Kevin and couldn't have imagined that he would have done something like this. He said, you know, most Marines talk about doing things like, I'm gonna beat that guy, or, you know.
Well, yeah.
And it's all talk. So it was a real shock when Kevin was arrested for murdering someone. Then another person commented in the thread who said they also served with Kevin and said they would have never thought, like, yeah, huh. Never in a million years. It makes me wonder, and I have no, like, I didn't see anything about his mental health evaluation, but sounds like schizophrenia to me, just because of the paranoia, like the shift in his behavior. Maybe that was the onset of symptoms if people didn't know him in that capacity before.
Well, and I ask, I mean, did he go overseas? Did he go to war?
I don't know.
Because that plays a lot in PTSD, yeah. And PTSD can make you unravel for sure.
Sure, yeah, and that's a good point. He got more aggressive in prison, which I'll tell you about in just a minute. But like I said, I found that thread on Reddit. I'll link it in the show notes so you can have a look at it. Take it for what you will. It's not like a credible news outlet.
Fact checked.
It's just like interesting that you would hear people say that. But the state worked long hours preparing for trial, gathering every shred of evidence that Kevin Cossey was a violent murderer who had planned Alvin's demise from the start. No one on the defense was preparing for anything, though, because Kevin decided to represent himself. The hubris. But through the pretrial phase, there came a point where it was clear that Kevin was not competent to stand trial.
Okay.
And he was actually hospitalized in a mental health care facility. He was treated and eventually cleared to go to trial. And surprisingly, the court said, yeah, I mean, go for it. You can represent yourself again.
Oh.
I mean, you just thought that they would have had a bad taste in their mouth from all the pre-trial stuff before having to deal with this guy who doesn't know what he's doing. But honestly, I don't think the court had a choice. I mean, if he passed his psych eval and he was deemed fit to stand trial, I don't think that there was anything.
Yeah, what could they do at that point?
I don't know. Now, Kevin's trial commenced in 2018, which was 5 years after he was arrested. So all that, you know, hospitalization, all that stuff just really drug everything out.
Yeah.
But here they were. It was time for him to finally pay for what he had done. Because they found a shank in Kevin's cell, they weren't sure that they wanted Kevin walking around freely in the courtroom like Ted Bundy when he represented himself in his little sweater vest and collared shirt.
Yeah.
It was suggested that Kevin be chained up and sit at the defense table, you know, have to conduct himself sitting down.
Right.
But the court decided that that would have meant the prosecution also would have had to sit during opening statements, witness, you know, cross-examinations, witness examinations. And so they ultimately decided against it. But I bet the guards
were on guard,
packing extra heat.
Yeah.
So the lead prosecutor, he gets up, he gives his opening statement, you know, a speech he had fashioned from hundreds of hours of work on Alvin's case. And in speaking with Alvin's family, really, really heartfelt and gave it all he got. And when he's done, he walks around the table, he sits down, and I imagine he had a sneaky bag of popcorn under there. Like, what's this guy going to say?
Right.
Like, what's his opening statement going to be like? Kevin Cossey stood up and he said he wanted to plead guilty to Alvin's murder.
Oh, I wonder, did he already have this planned, or after he heard the opening statement, he's like, okay, he's got me.
I can't do that. I cannot. I have nothing to say to that. The courtroom must have been devoid of oxygen in that moment with everyone gasping at the same time. You know, this type of thing does not typically happen.
No.
You know, you're kicking off trial. It's day one. It's exciting. You know, prosecution has been amping up for this. They've delivered their statement. All of that research and preparation. All of the organizing the witness list and all of it, everyone involved in the work. And this guy gets up and like part of them was probably like, well, fine. That means I don't have to continue with this.
We don't have to waste any more time.
I'm not wasting any more time. But the other part is like, are you freaking kidding me?
Oh, you don't get to just do that.
You don't get to do that. Well, the state did agree to a deal with Kevin. In exchange for a guilty plea, the state dropped the special circumstance charge, which would have taken Kevin down for life without parole.
Huh.
You know what? Maybe it's just because I'm a ball buster. But I don't feel like they had to take the special circumstance charge off the table. No. Like, did they have to do that? I feel like Kevin had wasted so much of everyone's time. They could have been like, you want to plead guilty? Then plead guilty. And right. That's it.
Like, I mean, he just pled guilty. So, all right, let's wash our hands.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the state had all the power in that situation.
I mean, unless I could see him saying, but if you take this charge away, I'll give you the story of what happened.
Yeah, I don't think there was anything like that.
Okay. Well, then that makes no sense. I think
they had pretty much worked out everything that had happened. Like, they had, it wasn't a situation where, like, the body hadn't been found and they were like, tell us where the body is. Yeah. Or, you know, something like that. I feel like he had no leverage.
Yeah.
So I don't, but hang on, because at sentencing, Kevin tried to withdraw his guilty plea.
Oh, for the love.
And plead not guilty, telling the judge he wanted a new trial judge. The judge. The judge said, yeah, as much as I would love to never see you again, that's not how this works,
yeah,
my dude. Though Kevin claimed he agreed to this plea deal under duress, everyone knew better than that. They were all there. We all saw what happened.
So this guy really should not have been let go on his psychiatric evaluation.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the thing about that is, you know, they'll put you in a hospital. They'll treat you.
Yeah.
So you're on meds. You're doing this regimen.
There you
go. And you'll get cleared.
There you go.
And is there a follow-up?
Then
I don't
what?
Know. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. Was he on medication? I don't know. Kevin was sentenced to 51 years to life, and he will have the possibility of parole someday. I don't know if this guy's ever going to qualify for it because of just how angry,
uh-huh,
how violent he seems to be. He has no remorse for what he did. And I'm not sure how he's behaved in prison thus far. Right. There's not been anything of note. But like I said, I wonder if he's continuing to receive treatment.
Right.
Because he's obviously a very disturbed individual.
Yeah.
Now, the limitation with telling, you know, a story that didn't see trial is that there are a lot of unanswered questions. I wasn't able to access Alvin's autopsy report because law enforcement had sealed it during the investigation. And while it was likely going to be an exhibit at trial and entered into the record, it wasn't. So, I don't know if it was the stab wounds that killed him or if it was the gunshot wounds, how badly he suffered through that. But I just imagine he suffered so badly through that death. Yeah. Alvin's life was celebrated by his friends and family in Fallbrook shortly after his body was found and his remains were sent to the Philippines where he was laid to rest. Alvin's family told San Diego News 7 that they didn't want to focus on Alvin's sexual orientation.
Right.
Because they didn't feel that it was important. And they certainly didn't feel like it should have gotten him killed.
Well, no, but it is what he was doing.
That's the thing. I agree with the family. I don't think it should. It's only relevant as to why we believed he was murdered
that night.
But I think we would be remiss if we didn't recognize how much harder it was for Alvin to be a military man and trying to find love in a military situation. How do you even... I have gay friends and I've asked them this before, like, how do you know someone's interested in you? How do you know someone is also gay? And they're like, you just know. But I just wonder, like, how do you know if you're in a military setting with a bunch of other men?
And they play around anyways.
Exactly. Yeah. So the roughhousing and the, you know, it must have been so hard for him to find love. And the fact that someone sought him out and took advantage of him solely to kill him.
Yeah.
It's so, so sad. He just wanted to be happy. He was juggling his family business, trying to date, his position in the military, all while moving up in the ranks. Alvin was amazing, and he would have no doubt continued to make the world a better place.
He sounds amazing.
Yeah.
He wanted to do big things, and he did in his short life.
I know. I always love hearing about immigrants coming to America, and they immediately just shine. Yeah. They're like, I'm not wasting any time getting a job or getting in the military or, you know, starting a business or, and it's just, you know, that reminds you of what America, like true why America.
People want to come to
right,
America.
That's why they want to come here. And so that's the story of Alvin Bullaroo. And luckily, you know, he did get justice.
Yeah.
It just is so heartbreaking to me what was done to him.
I mean, at the beginning, I thought you were going to say there was no investigation and all of that. And I was going to get...
Well, it kind of felt like they weren't going to.
And then they did an amazing job. Yeah, amazing. I mean, they worked hard on that. I think
once they found him, they were like, oh, heck yeah. No. You know, like, you're not going to do us like that. You're not going to do this victim like that and get away with it.
Okay, but then my next question is, there's a confession in his journal that this is the third time.
I knew you were going to ask about that.
Can we know who the other two were? Was it someone, was it an enemy at war? Or was it...
Yeah, I don't know.
An enemy in his mind?
I don't know. It's possible that he's talking about maybe kills overseas. I don't know. It's possible that he liked that.
Yeah.
He liked killing.
It sounds like that.
I don't have any knowledge of him being deployed or anything like that.
Okay.
And they weren't able to track down these two other supposed victims. So,
and of course he wasn't going to tell about it.
Right.
So,
mm-hmm.
Ew.
Yeah.
Well, good job to the investigators, to the detectives. You got justice.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for telling of his story. That's what a great guy.
Yeah. He's so cute. He does look like a cookie. His mom's a cookie.
Cookie. So sweet.
And his family was so proud of him.
Wow. Thank you for telling of his story.
Yeah.
That was great. Let's do it again sometime.
Let's do it. Bye, guys.
Bye. Thanks for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying the show, please rate and review wherever you listen and consider joining our Patreon for bonus episodes every month.
Follow us on Instagram and Facebook for case photos and to stay up to date with the latest C-on-C news. If you have a case suggestion or just want to tell us how cool we are, email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.